This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Starts at 11:30 p.m. KPFT Houston.
Welcome to another edition of the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host. A pleasure to be with you here on June 21st, 10:01 and a half minutes, broadcasting to you from our studios at 90.1 KPFT FM, Houston, Texas, on the World Wide Web at www.newcapitalshow.com. And if you are a user of iTunes, you can also pick up the New Capital Show on a podcast on iTunes as well. Let's get right to some news items. We're going to be taking your calls a little bit later in the show. The number here is 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. Lots and lots of news. It's like my computer hard drive is piling up, but let's see if we can turn, of course, to one of our favorite topics, energy. A tremendous amount going on the energy front as the new energy bill that is being worked on by Congress is being worked on. It's being hammered on. It's being lobbied on, as I described last week, and that continues to be the case. Let's see. News has just come out recently that, in fact, the effort to subsidize the transformation of coal into liquid fuel that could be used, a type of diesel, the effort to subsidize that on behalf of coal companies, that may in fact fail. That looks like it's going to be knocked out. I tell you that fossil fuel companies, alternative energy companies, they are all in there trying to get subsidized to be able to do their business. And of course, the thing that I've talked about on this show so often, really one of the very bedrock premises of this show, is that those types of subsidies in the end really don't help. They don't help a free market. They don't help the natural development of technologies, and it causes distortions in the economy. And we've seen that happen in the case of fossil fuels for decades and decades, and it's part of the reason why we are where we are, which is so beholden to fossil fuels and without a proper alternative energy infrastructure. As Amy Goodman pointed out at the top of her show just about an hour ago, the United Nations is now estimating that some $70 billion in alternative energy investments were made last year, largely by private investment concerns, whether that's companies, whether that's venture capitalists funding startup companies, whether that's large companies making investments in other divisions. The investment in alternative energy is by and large coming from private interests, and I think it's a delight to see that. The estimate is that's going to increase, and the increase to $70 billion was a 43% increase. So many tens of billions of dollars in increase from the year previous to that. And it's expected to continue to grow very rapidly. There's an article in it's an article in Time magazine, I think it's this week. The cover story is Michael Bloomberg, who's now in the news. I don't think it's any coincidence that he appeared on Time magazine and then changed parties. And Arnold Schwarzenegger. I've talked about Schwarzenegger's effort in California. And the article talks about the fact that local government, and in this case municipal governments, are jumping into a vacuum. One of the people quoted in the article says that nature abhors a vacuum. And he says there's a huge vacuum at the federal level in terms of government. And so we're seeing exactly the type of efforts to fill the vacuum, the lack of leadership at our federal level, at the municipal level, and as I just pointed, as Amy pointed out, in private investment that's going into alternative energy investments. You yourself are able to participate. If you think that these investments are going to yield a return, and you think that they're going to work out, you were able to do this. There are mutual funds that now focus on what's being called clean technology, green investing, which might be in energy sector, might be in materials, it might be in processes, it might be in things like filtration. And my advice to you is that if you're interested in this, that you do it through a diversified fund. I don't think it makes much sense for most people to try to bet on any particular company or any particular technology. Some are gonna make it. Some are gonna make it big. Some are gonna just do mediocre, and some are gonna fail. That's the nature of new businesses. When you look at the venture capital industry, any good venture capitalist will tell you that when they make investments, that's generally the type of result that they're gonna see. If they fund 10 companies to start 10 companies. Three are going to be great. Four are going to be just so-so, average or thereabouts. And three are going to fail. They're not going to make it. And that's exactly what we're going to see in this sector. And so my advice to you is that you seek out some type of fund that is diversified. If you're interested in making investments in that area, then that would be the way to do it. That would be the way to do it. Anyway, so some news out of China on the CO2 front. I didn't think this was coming as fast as it has come, but it has. Let's see. Where's the article? And of course, it's nowhere here. Anyway, I'll give you the headline. China is now the world's number one CO2 emitter. China's passed the U.S., Now, that makes sense because they've got four times the number of people as we have, but they were consuming energy at a much lower rate as of a couple of decades ago. And they still are. They still are. Obviously, we would expect if they consumed energy, in this case fossil fuel energy, if they consumed fossil fuel energy at the same rate that we do, then they would have four times the emissions that we have, right? They have four times the population. So on a per capita basis, they would have four times the emissions. Not on a per capita basis, on a total basis, if they had the same per capita emissions. But this has happened incredibly rapidly, as far as I can tell. Of course, China gets the majority of its energy, 66% plus, from the burning of coal. And it's no mystery, therefore, that two of the three largest countries that have refused to sign on to the Kyoto Protocol are China and the United States. And of course, both of these countries are sitting there looking at each other saying, well, you know, if he doesn't do it, I'm not going to do it. The article in Time magazine on Schwarzenegger and Bloomberg point out that politicians, progressive politicians, people who are leading their communities, are not waiting. They're not going to wait. They are putting in place local regulations which will cut CO2 emissions. And the thing that they are pointing out now is absolutely correct, which is that it's not going to hurt their economies. In fact, it's going to help their economies. It's going to make their municipalities popular places to live. Children are not going to be contracting asthma simply by going outside and playing. Water supplies will be clean. Air will be clean. And returns on investment are going to be high. Waste is going to be lessened. And I see some of this happening here in the city of Houston under the leadership of Bill White. I don't think it's quite to the extent that we are seeing it in California and New York. And that's part of the reason is because you and I, don't think support, and when I say you and I mean collectively, all of us listening out there, all of us driving around right now, we in Texas do not totally support the same type of level of change as these other places. As I said last week in my editorial, I hope that's changing. I think it is changing, and I don't think that the leadership in Texas, especially the conservative Republican leadership, sees what's coming. I think it's coming. I really do. I get email, I get notes every day saying it's coming. And I think there's a tremendous amount of good news. Let's take a look a little bit at this energy bill going through Congress. June 20, Senate Finance Committee approved $28 billion in tax breaks on Tuesday to underwrite renewable fuels and clean coal technology, all at the expense of the oil industry. Again, this article came out before, I think just a day or two after that, the clean coal provision did not pass. It was defeated fairly decisively. The coal industry would reap substantial benefits from the committee package, which is to be attached to a broader energy bill being debated on the Senate floor. I still think it's instructive to take a look at what the coal industry was trying to get into this thing. As I've said, this industry survives on subsidies. The biggest subsidy of all, of course, is the fact that they do not have to pay any, what I would call a license fee, any type of remediation fee, any type of remedial license fee for the vast amount of CO2 emissions that take place from consumption of coal. Which is to say that electric energy that is generated from coal is too cheap. Now, I know a lot of you think, that is crazy. Look at my electric bill. It has gone through the roof. You know, I'm sorry, friends. It's just a fact. There is a huge externality in the combustion of coal, the emission of CO2, for which there is no payment made right now whatsoever, except by our environment. And it's time for us to pay the bill. If we use that kind of electricity, then we need to pay the bill. We can't put the bill on the atmosphere. Right now, the atmosphere is paying the bill. And so, what the coal industry knows is that regulation of CO2 is coming. It's probably going to be here by, I would say, 2012. Let's say that George Bush is gone as president by 2008. It's going to take a couple years to get the mechanisms in place, get everything planned out, and probably another couple of years after that, 2012, let's call it, we'll see some kind of cap and trade system, maybe an outright tax. We're going to see some type of charge for emitting carbon. And so the coal industry, seeing that coming, sees this new bill coming and says, all right, we're going to be forced, our customers are going to be forced to pay the true cost of our energy. So we got to do something to go out and get some money back. And this is exactly how our government works. This bill that is being discussed is presumably going to come at the expense of oil companies. And the reason is oil companies don't have a lot of support among Democrats. Oil companies are pretty much Republican types or affiliated. It's not true in all cases, but by and large, over history, oil companies have been affiliated with the Republican Party. And so they are going to be asked to foot the bill for a lot of these subsidies that are going to be coming. And by the way, a lot is going to be coming to alternative energy. The coal guys, however, a lot of the coal states, West Virginia, Illinois, you know, Pennsylvania, these states still have large Democratic populations. And so you find that Democrats are still, to some degree, beholden to the coal business. And so the coal business has a greater ability to yank down subsidies out of this new bill, in fact, than the oil companies do. Even though, in my opinion, you know, there should be no subsidies there. In fact, there should be regulation. Now, I'm not necessarily for subsidies in alternative energy either. The reason that there are subsidies that are going to be given to alternative energy sources is because there are subsidies that are being given to the fossil fuel sources of energy. And as I've said, this is just like people standing on their tippy toes in a parade. Right? You've got a parade that's five rows deep. The first row, they don't have to do anything to see the floats going by. They can stand flat-footed. But the second row, right, they got to see over the first row. They stand on their toes. And that makes what? The third row have to stand on their toes, and the fourth and the fifth and so on. Soon, no one has a better view. They have the same view that they had when everybody was standing comfortably and flat-footed. Now they're standing uncomfortably on their toes. No one has a better view. And that's exactly what's happened with subsidies into the energy sector of this country. The fossil fuel guys have got it, so the alternative energy guys have got to get it. It would be far better to do away with all of the subsidies, take an honest look at which sources of energy have costs associated with them that are being externalized, and assess a fee, whether it's a tax or a cap and trade system or whatever the case may be, to ameliorate those external costs. And then everybody's paying the true costs. And by the way, to the extent that solar panels require fossil fuels to manufacture them, or wind turbines require fossil fuels to manufacture them, the cost of the regulation on fossil fuels will indeed pass through to those customers as well, as it should. What we need is a fair system, and the fairest system is to get the government out of the business of making subsidies. In fact, that's not going to happen. It's not going to happen here in this bill. In fact, this bill is all about subsidies. In many ways, I agree with the Wall Street Journal, which says this is... What do they say? June 15th. This is from their editorial. They're decrying the coal-to-liquid subsidy rush. I usually never agree with the editorial section of the Wall Street Journal, but on this day they said, the coal-to-liquid subsidy rush is one more sign that taxpayers will be the biggest losers in our current energy panic. Our politicians will even subsidize carbon-emitting coal in the name of reducing dependence on carbon-emitting but unsubsidized oil. The alternative fuels campaign is on its way to becoming the biggest corporate welfare scheme in U.S. history. I don't know about that. I don't know if the alternative fuels campaign is on its way to becoming the biggest corporate welfare scheme in U.S. history. But I do agree with, I think, the basic point of the Wall Street Journal, which is that the way to let this happen is to get the government out of the business of picking which of these technologies is going to win. The government has to, however, stay in the business of regulating the overall environment. If the government sees that a certain type of technology... Now, leave that aside. The government doesn't even have to decide that about the technology. All the government has to do is to protect the commons. All the government has to do is say, our role as the government is to protect the common resources. The water, the land, and indeed the air. And we now know that CO2 is a pollutant. CO2 is a pollutant. Part of the job of the government, one of the jobs of the government, is to protect the air. And therefore, any process in this country which harms the air has to be remediated. Either it has to be prevented from occurring, or there has to be a charge for it taking place. You and I, as citizens, cannot cause harm to the general public. And of course, this is why we are seeing such a snowballing effect of people flowing to progressive and liberal causes once again. It's why there's such a tremendous sense of hope that's growing out there. It's why Republicans are going to be tossed out of office next year. You heard it here. They're gone. And they know it. They're putting on a game face. But they're toast. And then the real work begins. Why is it? It's because the myth of the rugged individual, right? The myth of the rugged individual and individual freedom, which, of course, we liberals and progressives believe in. We believe in individual freedom. Very much so. But there's another side of our coin as well. We believe in cooperation. We believe in mutual support. We believe in community. If we're going to have a nation, we believe that those things have to be in play as well. And we believe that we don't have the right to harm the common good. And we think that there is a place that a political economy can exist which respects the right of the individual and also respects the right of the commons. And my friends, that is really where politics in this country is groping for. Indeed, politics in the world. How do we preserve the liberty and the freedom of the individual? How do we allow the individual to come to their full fruition and their full potential? And yet, how do we protect the brilliance and the sanctity of the commons? Through cooperation and respect. You cannot do that with an ideology that focuses utterly, totally, and completely, and myopically, on the rights of the individual. The commons has a right too. We, as a group of people, have a right to a clean environment. We have a right to education. We have a right to health care. And you are seeing that these things are coming front and center into play in the national dialogue. A little more news on the financial front. Congress weighs in to hedge fund tax break. Maybe you've seen some of the discussion that's going on about how hedge funds and private equity funds, generally people who have grown quite wealthy. Let me first explain how they work. There's no magic here. Basically, these are investment pools. Don't be bamboozled. Don't think, oh, hedge funds, or private equity funds. Magic. Mystery. Black magic boxes that generate money. It's, my friends, these are investment pools. They're the same investment pool as if you got together, you know, with some friends and formed an investment club and pooled your money into some accounts. You'd be doing the same thing. You'd be pooling money and making investments. It's the same investment pool as a mutual fund that you might own or a pension fund that you might own or any kind of family partnership. You might be in business with family members. It's an investment pool. Or the very government of this country itself is an investment pool. It taxes us. It brings in money. And then the people of control of the money make investment decisions. Yeah, we know. They've been absolutely appallingly bad investment decisions at that level. All these are investment pools. What's the catch? The catch is that the people who run the investment pools, generally these are what are known as a limited partnership. In a limited partnership, they're basically two types of partnerships. One is called a general partnership, when all of the partners have a vote and a say in how the thing is run. There may be someone who manages it, a managing partner. But each of the partners has some power, some voting power, and can vote out managing partners and make operating changes to the partnership. A limited partnership, there is what is called a general partner. And believe it or not, the general partner generally owns a very small amount of the limited partnership. Call it 1%. So even though, and the general partner has all of the decision-making power. So these are not extraordinarily democratic institutions, limited partnerships. 99% of the partners are the limited partners, and they are exactly that. They're limited. They have no say, and they can't get rid of the general manager. The general partner. Can't get rid of it. It's done. You signed up. The general partner is the general partner. And in a hedge fund and a private equity fund, the general partner is usually the promoter, the founder, the starter, the investor of the funds, the people running the money. And as the general partner, they have the right to set all types of stipulations. Stipulations like, your money will be locked up for 7 years, don't ask for it back, you can't get it back. We will make the decisions where the money goes. And by the way, here are the charges that we're going to assess you. And here are the charges. Well, my friends, think about your just sort of standard mutual fund. The average fee of a mutual fund in this country is about, I don't know, call it 1.5%. Index funds, which, by the way, I advocate, charge much less. These are funds that are passive. It's not stock picking. Somebody's not trying to actually go out and make, you know, market beating decisions. Just a standard index fund. You may have heard of the S&P 500 or the Dow Jones index. These are indexes. They're portfolios, by the way, and they are selected, but there's a passive element to them. Oftentimes, their charges can be as little as 0.2%. So 1.5% for an average mutual fund and 0.2% for an index fund. Well, what's a hedge fund? Private equity funds. They charge generally 2% a year, and this is on the total amount of money in the partnership. Doesn't matter whether the fund goes up or down. And then there is another piece. If the fund shows a profit, so let's say that the value of the fund goes up 10% in 1 year, they take generally an additional 20% of the profit. So 20% of the profit on a 10% profit would be 2%. So now you see that a private equity fund or a hedge fund, simply through its fee structure, takes 2% a year, plus let's say that things go up, and they have been going up very, very much so in the past 7 years or so. Let's say that it's gone up about 10% a year. In some cases, it's gone up much more. But let's just say 10%. Their annual fee is 4%. The 2% management fee plus the 20% of the 10% profit, which is 2%. So there you see why these entities have been making lots and lots of money. This is not AIM, you know, or Fidelity or Vanguard charging 1% for a fund. They're making four times that amount, 4% on huge amounts of money. And now Congress is getting interested. June 21st, New York Times. Congress weighs end to hedge fund tax break. What is the tax break? The tax break, my friends, is that extra 2% that I just told you about, that 2% of the profit, or that 20% of the profit, it's taxed at a long-term capital gains tax rate, which is 15%. One of the lowest taxes in this country, maybe the lowest tax, is 15%. Now, if they were taxed on a short-term capital gains tax basis, it would be more like 35% tax. And of course, you, out there listening, the majority of you, will pay your taxes, most of your taxes, in the form of an income tax. And your tax is probably minimum 15%, more like 20, 25, 30, 35. So what we have in this case is some of the wealthiest, richest people in this country paying the least amount of taxes. Now, the long-term capital gains tax rate has been lowered by the Bush administration to 15%. But by the way, it's been lowered all the way since Ronald Reagan. Used to be much higher. It was down to 30, 25. And the theory there is that you don't want to create a disincentive for investment. If you tax capital long-term capital at a high rate, you will create a disincentive to make long-term investments. There's quite a bit of me that agrees with that. But these guys are getting their low tax rate, 15%, on a profit on someone else's money. It's not even their money. Remember, they're taking 20% of a notional annual profit on the fund. And Congress is weighing an end to that. Leaders of the tax writing committees in Congress are considering a new proposal to end a little-known tax break that has allowed wealthy financiers who run private equity firms and hedge funds to cut their total income tax bills by billions of dollars, aides to lawmakers say. By the way, these funds have made about $50 billion in the past, say, 5 years. $50 billion. And I would say that the majority of that has been not in the management fee, but it's been in the profit piece. So let's say of the $50 billion, $30 of it has been in what's called the carried interest, the profit incentive. $30 billion have been the profits. And so let's say the tax on that has been $5 billion. So if the tax were to be doubled, that would be an additional $5 to $6 billion that would come into the government. And I think that's what's being looked at right now. Oh, yep, here it is. By contrast, the new proposal would affect many more firms and could raise $4 to $6 billion annually. Annually. It may be attached to a tax bill expected as early as July as a way of helping offset the cost to the Treasury of relieving the growing burden of the alternative minimum tax. What we have going on, folks, is a reassessment of our tax code, a reassessment of how things should be taxed after, you know, going on 25 years of Republican rule in the country. And I think it's not a moment too soon. Let's see. One more item here. This is talking about Denmark. There's an article in Time magazine about Denmark, where, and the title of the article is Where Retirement Works. And the article points out that Denmark is a place where retirement funding is being done successfully and has been planned successfully by the government. And it's done it two ways. It's provided defined benefit programs, defined benefit programs, which are otherwise known as pension funds, and also defined contribution programs, which we would know as 401k plans. So it's provided both of those, and it's done it by mandating that defined benefit pension plans must be in place by employers. And of course, in this country, employers have been running to get out of their defined benefit obligations. My friends, the plans that you have for your future, you need to think about very, very carefully. I received a shock the other day. I got a visit from one of the development directors from the school that I graduated from, the college, and they're trying to raise money. And I said, what's tuition, by the way, these days? $45,000. $45,000, my friends, to go to, you know, private university. $45,000. So, if you're looking at doing that kind of thing for children, you've got to figure out how to put money away. If you're looking at retiring, you've got to figure out how to put money away. And there is an awful lot of nonsense that is out there. You cannot rely only on the federal government. You've got to put some savings aside, and you've got to be very, very careful that you do it in an efficient way, and I say tax-efficient way, fee-efficient way. There's a lot of nonsense out there. If you turn on television on Saturday, you'll see infomercials trying to encourage you to become a day trader. I'm not kidding you. They show seminars packed with people trying to entice you to come and we'll show you how to trade. It's nonsense, my friends. You could turn on probably several stations on AM radio right now and listen to this sort of nonsense. We're going to teach you how to trade. You need to become a day trader. This company's trading. It's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. There is absolutely no evidence that any of those types of methods will provide you with any type of return that is meaningful to you. You need to set your plans, you need to invest for your future, and you need to do so using tried methods. And the tried method is to make long-term investments and to hold them. One more article I want to turn to, then we'll take a break. 713-526-5738. We will have time for a few calls. 713-526-KPFT. This is a very, very interesting article to me. It went to the top of the New York Times email list. I am always fascinated by what winds up at the top of the New York Times email list. It's never something like, you know, President Bush says this, announces that, war in Iraq that. It's always something very, very unique. Recently, it was our city's own Mark Bent and his flashlight, his solar-powered flashlight. Mark came on a few days after that appeared. It's always something very, very interesting that shows how I think people are thinking about what is interesting and where value is. This is, here it is. In the classroom, a new focus on quieting the mind. Oakland, California, June 12th. The lesson began with the striking of a Tibetan singing bowl to induce mindful awareness. With the sound of their new school bell, the fifth graders of Piedmont Avenue Elementary School, here in Oakland, closed their eyes and focused on their breathing as they tried to imagine loving kindness on the playground. Alex Minton, 11 years old, said, "I was losing at baseball, and I was about to throw a bat. The mindfulness really helped," he said. As summer looms, students at dozens of schools across the country are trying hard to be in the present moment. This is what is known as mindfulness training, in which stress-reducing techniques drawn from Buddhist meditation are wedged between reading and spelling tests. Mindfulness, while common in hospitals, corporations, professional sports, and even prisons, is relatively new in the education of squirming children. But a small but growing number of schools in places like Oakland and Lancaster, Pennsylvania, are slowly embracing the concept, as they did yoga 5 years ago. And institutions like the psychology department at Stanford and the Mindfulness Awareness Research Center at UCLA are trying to measure the effects. During a five-week pilot program at Piedmont Avenue Elementary, Miss Megan, the mindful coach, visited every classroom twice a week, leading 15-minute sessions on how to have gentle breaths and still bodies. The sound of the Tibetan bowl reverberated at the start and finish of each lesson. At Stanford, the psychology department is assessing the feasibility of teaching mindfulness to families, said Philippe Golden, a researcher. "Parents and teachers tell kids 100 times a day to pay attention, but we never teach them how." Angela Hake, the principal of Piedmont, said she was inspired to try it after observing a class at a local middle school. Dr. Hake said, "If we can help children slow down and think, they have the answers within themselves. It seemed alternately loved and ignored as students in the Ms. Graham's fifth grade class tried to pay attention to their breath, a calming technique that lasted 20 seconds. Then their coach asked them to cultivate compassion by reflecting on their emotions before lashing out at someone on the playground. Tyron Williams defined mindfulness as not hitting someone in the mouth. His mother, Tawana Thomas, said he doesn't know what to do with his energy. But one day after school, he told me, 'I'm taking a moment. If it works in the child's mind with so much going on, there must be something to it.'" My friends, this is another example of enlightenment and progressive ideals in action in this country that are starting to penetrate the greater population at large. It all goes together. Energy intelligence, foreign policy, domestic policy, healthcare policy, and mindfulness in elementary schools. All of it fits together, and it's increasingly fitting together as we in this country understand the way forward and the path forward. We're going to take your calls in just a second, but before we do, I'd like to try mindfulness on the radio. I'd like to take, well, let's take 60 seconds. I'd like you to sit up straight, take some breaths, and when we talk about mindfulness, really what we're talking about is letting go of your mind. We're talking about letting go of the problems and the planning, of the tape recorder of your mind running through all of the issues that are in your life, and letting go so that you can actually become mindful again of your humanity. I'm going to ring a bell, we'll take 60 seconds, and then we'll be back. Capital Show, www.newcapitalshow.com. Also, if you're interested in working on the show, we've got a few slots open in research and technical work. Simply drop me a line. You can do so at www.newcapitalshow.com. We've got a great team of people put together, and if you're interested in participating in public community radio, it's a great way to do it. With that, we're going to go to the phone, 713-526-5738. We've got about 15 minutes left. Jose is first up. Is it Jose or Josie?
It's Jose.
Jose, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I am 35 years old, and I work at a fairly small company in Houston, and it does pretty well. And in December, I was approached by my employer to see if I wanted to invest in our 401k program at work. And I don't know very much about 401k, and I just, you know, it seems to be doing pretty well from what I understand, but I just really, more than anything, I don't really know the questions to be asking. All I really know is that there's a percentage of my check, the percentage of money that they're taking out of my check each week, and I don't really know what it's doing. You know,
Jose, let me ask you this. Are they matching any of your contributions?
They are matching, yes.
Okay.
I'm fully vested from what I understand.
Okay.
And I take about 5% of my income that they take out of my check, and I only make about $45,000 a year.
And what is their match? Are they matching the full 5%?
They are matching the full 5%.
Okay. Well, my friends, 401ks are a very, very good program, especially if your employer is matching your contribution. That's what we call free money. It's about the closest thing to free money that you're going to get, many of us. I mean, a lot of people in power structures get plenty of free money, but for rank and file workers like you, Jose, that's about as close to free money as you're going to get. So I certainly recommend it, because you're getting a 10% contribution, half of it which is coming from you and half from the employer. In addition, 401ks are tax deferred plans, which is to say that the income that accrues in the fund, whether that's capital gains as stocks are bought and sold, or interest that comes off of coupons from bonds, all of that, none of it is taxed while it is in the plan. And so you get a tax deferral benefit from the plan. Now, ultimately, when you take the money out, it's going to be taxed, but that'll be much later on when you retire. The only thing that you need to be careful of in a 401k plan is that very often employees are given just a huge list of potential funds to put things in, and it can be very, very confusing. It's not an easy thing to make a good allocation of a portfolio. I mean, professionals spend a lot of time trying to do that. So if you're not sure about that, then I would recommend that you try to get some help in how to allocate the funds. Another gotcha is that companies may mandate that you have to put a bunch into the company stock. I don't know if that's the case with you or not, or if your company is public, but if it's a public company, my advice to you is not to put your money into company stock, but instead to put it into a diversified portfolio. So, but overall, I would say that the plan is 401ks are good, and especially if you're getting that matching, and I would encourage you to put as much as you can into it.
Okay.
All right?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jose. Bye-bye. Next up is going to be our friend Joe. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hello?
Yep, you're on, Joe.
Okay. One of the things that I'd like to... this is Abadi. Hey, Joe.
Oh, hey, Abadi.
How you doing, Leo?
Good.
One of the things I'd like to encourage you to do is to... you're doing an incredible job of dancing on the edge. And the edge is to also advocate for ownership of the public commons by the people. Therefore, the issues that come up with the coal industry, the issues that come up with the oil industry, all of those issues would evaporate if the public owned the public commons. The oil companies and the coal companies had nothing to do with the creation of the natural resources that should belong to the people.
But Abadi, I think we do have that to some great degree. I mean, we have public lands and we have public waters. Don't you think that part of the problem has been that the federal government has been leasing these properties? I mean, one of the problems is the federal government has been leasing these properties at subsidized rates, you know, whether it's grazing for cattle in the West or now it's drilling for natural gas in the Rockies and in Alaska. I mean, my understanding, I don't know what yours is that these lease rates have been very much below market. And the Clinton administration apparently made a huge blunder. They issued all kinds of leases in the Gulf of Mexico at ridiculously low rates. So my question is, it sounds to me like in that case, we do own, the people do own the resources, but the government is mismanaging the leases on them.
Well, it seems to me also, Leo, that government is what power structures use to commit theft and plunder of the public treasury.
So how do we take it back? How do you take the government back?
We take it back by, first of all, rejecting the mythology that somehow the average citizen benefits by ensuring that the corporations that take full advantage of that same public are allowed to operate without realizing that much of the profits that they earn are basically being subsidized through the tax revenues. And once we understand that and we stop subsidizing them and stop allowing the conversation and the argument to be couched in terms of what is in the best interest, you know, should there be subsidies, et cetera, et cetera. No one talks about the end result of profits to those industries and enterprises that have been subsidized, of monies that have been given to them that have been plundered from the public coffers. We need to
Well, what you're suggesting is it confers on shareholders of companies ill-gotten gains.
Well, of course, but the system is rigged to do just that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's nothing fair or there's nothing equitable about the influence that corporations exert through their lobbyists, et cetera, et cetera.
I think you and I agree. I mean, I think I would say that if you are the shareholder of a company that is receiving federal subsidies and a leg up in that way, that you are getting ill-gotten gains as a shareholder. I would agree with that 100%.
Well, I hope you'll move forward and appreciating the example that Hugo Chavez is offering to the world. And that's the number one thing that turns and, you know, and it makes people go, you know, go purple.
I've been invited, actually, to go to Venezuela. I'm not able to go when it's going because I've already got plans, but it's my hope that maybe I'll be able to go on such a trip at some point. So
the public needs to take ownership of the public commons.
I agree.
Thank you.
I agree with that. Anything that is within the realm of anything, do I agree with it? In a lot of cases, I agree with it. Air, water. Do I think that the government can control all public resources? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe it's necessary, maybe it's not. What I'm gratified to see is that we are again turning our attention to this issue of subsidies and fair cost. I mean, to me, whether it's owned by the public or it's owned by private interests, the main thing is that the cost be right. The cost has to be right. Ownership is simply a question of title. So, you know, I agree with the body in certain circumstances. On the other hand, I think it is possible that it's irrelevant. The issue is government putting in place proper regulations to protect the commons and to ensure that full costs are paid. Costs are the issue, ultimately. Next up is going to be, let's take Tyra and even up the gender tote board here. Tyra.
Hello?
Tyra, you're on.
Yes, hello. I love your show.
Thank you.
I have just written a master's degree at the University of Houston on renewable energy, and my focus was on solar. I was looking at from a policy perspective. So I was looking at solar, both the centralized as well as the photovoltaic that people could put on their roof. And I looked at distributed generation as well and sort of the digital grid.
Uh-huh. And what do you conclude?
In Europe, the policy that most quickly accelerates this entry into the market of solar technology is the feed-in tariff. And I think there needs to be more of a dialogue.
Describe that.
The feed-in tariff works with long-term contracts. These are 10-year contracts for suppliers, generators of solar, as well as other forms of renewable energy. They don't focus strictly on solar. And then it's priced according to the cost of that source of generation. So the generator gets paid higher, for example, for solar generation. In Europe, it's like 54 euro than they do for wind generation because the cost is higher.
Mm-hmm.
And the long-term aspect of it seems to be really key. It's a fixed price contract.
Well, Tyra, I mean, again, my point is either if other people are receiving subsidies, then you're either going to have to boost alternative energy with subsidies, which is what's going on in this country, to get them onto either a level or a logical playing field, or you've got to get rid of subsidies for everybody and make sure that those processes that have harmful effects, such as CO2 emissions, pay for those harmful effects. I would rather see the second model because it mirrors reality. It mirrors reality. This is a process that does harm. They have to pay for doing the harm. But instead, because we have a legacy in this country of energy that's being generated from fossil fuels, and these are companies that have enormous legacy cash flows. They have money to go hire lobbyists, and they are influence peddling in the government. The alternative energy business is having to do the same thing and come up with subsidies as well. So it may be we're going to get the result that we want. Certainly, as Amy Goodman's news item on the United Nations saying that $70 billion in private investments has gone into alternative energy in the past year, we're getting a much better result. That's compared to $1 trillion in fossil fuel investments. But, you know, we're getting close to 10% of fossil fuel investments going into alternative energy. It's pretty good. So,
but we've got almost 100 years of subsidies that have been going on for the fossil fuels.
It's right.
So we've, you know, there's a lot of catching up to be. And with these emerging markets, especially for solar, which is high tech, it's an emerging market, I strongly support subsidies, at least for a period of time. And I think that period of time should be about 10 years. And that includes the federal tax credits and rebates and everything else that we can plunge at. I really think. And
is your research available to people?
I haven't published it. I need, I'm in the market of searching for publishers at the moment. So I'm sorry, I'm not ready to release it until I get a publisher, but I'll let you know as soon as I do.
Okay.
I'd be happy to.
Tyra, thanks for the call.
Sure. And can I tell you one thing about a couple of events?
Real quick.
Okay. Austin Technology Incubator tonight, the solar solstice. They've got a guy coming in from the German parliament as well as a number of companies talking about solar.
That's going to be in Austin.
In Austin at 6:30 at MCC. Mm-hmm. You can find out about it at ati.org.
Great.
And Andre Dwani is coming to Houston on June 26th. He'll be at the Museum of Fine Art at 6:30 in the evening. And the
tell everyone who he is.
Andre Dwani is a legendary urban planner.
Yep.
And it's also being sponsored by the U.S. Green Builders Council, I believe.
He did the new urbanism?
Yes.
In, I want to say, Florida, Georgia, somewhere like that.
Yes. And if people would demand that when they buy a home in Houston, it has solar PV on the roof, I think we would be making a firm step in the right direction.
Tyra, thanks for the call.
Yes, sir.
We would like to get the mayor's new sustainability, czar, whatever he is, Chris Uexter. We're going to get him on. We're trying to get him on, and he was going to come on a couple of months ago. But he said, I'm new in the job, and I need a little more time to get my feet on the ground. I think we're just about at the point where Chris's feet are probably on the ground. We're going to get him on the show. We're going to have him talk about what can be done there, because, in fact, quite a bit can be done at the municipal level. I've said before, you could change people's behavior in the building by changing the building codes overnight. I mean, every single thing that you do in a new house has got to be permitted. And so simply by changing those codes, the city has enormous power to mandate what's going on, and that's what's happening in municipalities. We are just about out of time, my friends. I'm sorry, Joe and Herman, we're not going to be able to get to you today, but we will hopefully get to you next week. And again, anyone who wants to post a note, you can do so at www.newcapitalshow.com. You can send me email. You can sign up for the newsletters and mailings, special events, and other things as well. It's been my pleasure to be with you for another edition of the show, and I will be back with you next week. I hope you're enjoying your summer. I hope you have a great weekend, and I hope you take a moment, several moments, to be mindful. Take care.
The Gale and Hell Rios are key, and Katrina Moorhead, a thing called Early Blur. The Rios Salon will take place on Wednesday, June 20th at 6 p.m., and will feature University of Houston professor Rex Koontz. The Moorhead Salon, moderated by curator Claudia Smoothley, will take place on Wednesday, June 27th at 6 p.m., and will feature exhibiting artist Katrina Moorhead, with special guests Duncan Gangley, Joseph Abiel, and Tony Camp, senior curator. Contemporary Arts Museum Houston. Flower Gallery is located in the Fine Arts Building on U of H's Central Campus, entrance 16, off Cullen Boulevard. For more information, please call 713-743-9521 or visit flowergallery.org. This is KBFT, Houston.
Attention Houston residents, are you tired of air pollution, high asthma rates, flaring, and no voice in the political process? The People's Freedom Caravan is coming to your barrio to help bring attention to these issues in your community. Activists from New Mexico, San Antonio, and El Paso will be stopping at Hartman Park on Sunday, June 24th from noon to 2 p.m. to support the Manchester community in their struggle for a clean environment. The People's Caravan is stopping in Houston as it crosses the South on its way to Atlanta, Georgia for the United States Social Forum. Please join us in welcoming the caravan and give voice to the concerns of fence line communities in Houston's East End. Hartman Park is located at 9311 East Avenue P. We'll be there from noon to 2 p.m.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.